Only if you're ready, 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 ready. Let's go.
Hello and welcome to Divine Enigma, a podcast that talks about how to navigate through the complexities of the workplace as a modern day professional while simultaneously having a side hustle. We appreciate all of our audience members for taking some time out of their day to tune into another episode and look forward to providing you all with some value through our show today. My name is Sarah and I will be the host for this podcast. This podcast will be available on all platforms where you find podcasts, including Spotify, Amazon, and Apple Podcasts, and we're also on YouTube. So let's get started. Hello, Andrew. Welcome to Divine Enigma. How are you today?
I'm good, Sarah. Thank you. And thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you for being on. I'm really honoured that you've decided to come on the podcast and meet me. So, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
just wanted to quickly, let's just take our time and just embrace the fact that we're on this podcast. So do you mind introducing yourself to the audience members, what you do, and and explain your neurodivergent condition, because this podcast is mainly on people who have neurodivergent conditions, as well as we delve into project management as well, and running side hustles and being an entrepreneur overall. So yeah, introduce yourself to the audience members, tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll talk more about what you do as well.
Yeah, my name's Andrew McDonald. I use he, him pronouns. I call myself the neurodivergent copywriter, and the reason that I do that is both because I'm neurodiverse myself and I specialize in helping neurodivergent entrepreneurs to launch and scale their business through their marketing campaigns. What triggered me going into this specialism was that I found a lot of the advice given by marketing gurus and experts on how to market your business, how to get yourself out there and so on, didn't work for me. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of that was to do with my own neurodiversities. And I had to find other paths to launch and grow my business. I'm talking about all neurodivergent people, because there are methods. Neurodiverse people are as diverse as the people who identify as neurodiverse. You know, it's not a one size fits all kind of thing.
Exactly. So what is the difference between maybe somebody who is trying to start a business that are neurotypical? So obviously the neurotypical way of starting a business would be A, B, C, and then you scale. How would you kind of change that slightly for someone that's neurodiverse? Because there's different types of neurodiverse conditions. Mm-hmm. There's dyslexia, there's dyspraxia, there's, I think it's dyscalculia, I think that's how you say it, autism, like there's a spectrum. We're all, us folks, we're all different. So we want to make sure that, how would that kind of, I guess, work in terms of someone who wants to start a business, but they have a neurodiverse condition? I know there's some famous neurodivergents who are entrepreneur. So one that comes to mind is Richard Branson. Everyone knows he has dyslexia, and he talks very openly about his dyslexia as an entrepreneur, and he's very successful. But we have to be careful about just him being the reference point as of the only person that is a neurodivergent and a successful entrepreneur, because he has, he came with a lot of privileges. Like, she came from a quite privileged background. He may have had resources around him to help him get there, but there might be people that might not have those same tools who are neurodivergent. So how can we learn how to start a business as a neurodivergent and not just have a reference point as Richard Branson. Although he's an amazing entrepreneur, we need a bit more of a context around that, if that makes sense.
Yeah. What I would say is that I can't say that method A, B, and C will work for neurodivergent entrepreneurs. And I can't say that methods A, B, and C won't work for them, because it depends on the person themselves. So a really important part of my work is I take on board the whole kind of character, personality, philosophies of the business people that I work with. What I can talk about are some examples, but I don't want anyone to go away from this podcast and think, okay, Andrew's a copywriter and he's saying that this isn't going to work for me and this will. Absolutely not. One of the things that I found that didn't work for me was cold emailing. Cold emailing to build up clients, because one of my neurodiversities is that I have OCD. I'm also coming from a position of trauma, and I have rejection sensitivity disorder. So when I'm sending, if I send out lots of cold emails, then, of course, a lot of them are going to come back with no response, or they're going to come back with a negative response. And it's whether or not I can, overcome the challenge of receiving that. Obviously, everybody is challenged by that, but some people who are neurodiverse are more challenged by it than people who are neurotypical. So one of the methods that I encourage people to do that are neurodiverse, but again, it depends on the person themselves, is, for example, building a mailing list and doing it kind of organically, not kind of pushing the mailing list on people, but doing it like, for example, that I'm doing now. I'm talking to you, Sarah, on the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hopefully people will hear this and be interested to find out more about both of us.
Yeah.
And that is a sort of an organic way of building visibility, of building and of building things like a mailing list, so that you have people that you can contact about your, yes, about your services, but more importantly than that, you can build a community around yourself and your business that you offer value to.
So what would you say is the best way to build a mailing list for someone who's neurodiverse? Being that in your case, you're very sensitive to rejection. How would that, someone like yourself who is also sensitive to rejection, how would they go about building an email list and getting people to give their information to you so that you can contact them without you kind of being in that, it's me doing all the emails, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. One of the, well, first of all, to build any kind of mailing list, you need a lead magnet. You need something that you are happy to offer free to people that you know also has value to them. Something that you know that they'll want enough to give you their email address in return for it. So it could be an ebook, it could be a case study, it could be a webinar, it can be a free audit, it can be a quiz. There's a huge variety of things that you can use as a lead magnet. But the idea is that they land on a page on your website, and they enter their name and email address to get this, to get the lead magnet. And then they're on your mailing list. And one of the things that I help people with is not using a mailing list to do that sort of icky, hard selling.
Yeah.
You know, not this, buy this now, which is almost spam, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah. And it's cringy.
It's cringy. Yeah. And what I've noticed, look, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a scientist, I can't tell you this with any kind of security, but what I found is that a lot of neurodiverse people are a lot, and I want to reiterate that because I don't want to say all, a lot are quite sensitive and are quite sensitive to that sort of icky hard sale.
Yeah, that's like me. I like, if I'm being sold something and you keep, I just don't want to know anymore. And I just.
Yeah.
I'm like that. Yeah.
And it's not only that, not only are they sensitive to it, but they're sensitive to doing it. It doesn't feel right for them.
It does. Yeah.
So what I try to encourage people to do is to have a mailing list that they treat as a community. Okay, so they're offering free advice to people to the people that they serve without any kind of obligation to buy, but they're becoming a valued resource to those people, to their leads and to their clients, who then view the business person as almost a friend. And so that makes the sales process much, much softer, if you like.
Yeah.
You know, they know that they can get value from this person. They know, because of the way that the person has built a relationship with them, the business person has built a relationship with them, that they know that they are going to get value if they buy from them. They know that they're getting helped, and they're getting helped free anyway. So when they actually go to buy, they're in a position where they're ready to do so.
You trust the person more
because you
see them more genuine. You're not like, oh, come and buy my course. You actually trust them more because you can see there's a consistency, and you can see they're actually passionate about what they're actually offering you. They're not just doing it because they want money, and that's how I am. Very much, it's like, if someone just feels like, my husband's very much like this actually, if he feels any sense someone's just coming for money, he's like, no, don't go with them, they just want money. And it's like, you don't want that. You want someone that actually genuinely cares about what they're selling you, not someone who's just doing it. And I've always wanted to start a business, but I've always wanted to do something that I genuinely care about, not something I'm just doing for the sake of doing it. It has to come from a place that even if I'm not making a penny from it, it's fine, because I'm actually happy to do this. I'm actually happy to work in an area that I know that people's lives are changing, people are getting value from it. It's not about, oh, let me make. But when you feel that, you feel it. And I think because neurodiverse people are quite sensitive, you feel it. You feel this person ain't genuine. They're not. They're not real. Like, I don't want them around me. So yeah, I understand that. I understand that that icky feeling that you get, that you know that this person is just a sleazy salesperson, and nobody wants that. Nobody wants that.
And it's also about things like it's all well and good to have your lead magnet, to have the page on your website that is there to capture people's email addresses so that you can send them the lead magnet so that they become part of your mailing list. But you have to have some kind of visibility strategy.
So talk me through the visibility strategy and how that you'll kind of put that together for a neurodiverse person.
Again, it very much depends on the character and personality and challenges the individual faces themselves. Like, as I said at the beginning, there is no one size fits all. I spoke about struggling with cold emails. I am absolutely positive that there are neurodiverse entrepreneurs that are amazing with cold emails and build up very, very successful businesses. So it very much depends on the person themselves. There are a couple of strategies that you can use. For example, a blogging. You can guest blog on other people's blogs. do the same with podcasting. You can have your own podcast, you can go on other people's podcasts. Mm-hmm. And that is all building your visibility and building it so that you're out there, people are seeing you, and through links at the end of your blog pieces or podcast interviews, you can get them, you're directing them back to your mailing list. Now, that obviously is the idea of podcast guesting for somebody who is extremely introverted, extremely shy. It's mm-hmm. not going to work. So it's about finding those alternatives. What are other strategies? I mean, a good example is, I know people who are terrified of going to an in-person networking event.
Oh, gosh. But even if you're neurodiverse or neurotypical, mm-hmm. there are people that are genuinely afraid of in-person network events.
Yeah, but those people can do very well networking on something like LinkedIn or yes. Facebook. And you mm-hmm. can set up your LinkedIn and Facebook in such a way that it's driving people back to your mailing list again. There are different strategies, and there are different ones that work for different people. Also, I don't want to say that mailing lists. I talked a lot about mailing lists. I don't want to say that mailing lists are the only way of going about building a business as a neurodiverse person. I do think that any business, neurotypical or neurodiverse, that doesn't build a mailing list is missing out. But it's certainly not the only strategy. You know,
yeah.
And the message that I really want to get across is that not so much this is what will fit for you. It's more that if you're an entrepreneur, if your dream is to have your own business, and you're neurodiverse, yet the advice from gurus and experts about marketing your own business hasn't worked for you. The message I want to put across is you don't need to feel bad about that. You don't need to despair. You don't, and you certainly shouldn't give up.
Yeah.
There are hundreds of different strategies. Okay, and it's about finding the ones that fit for you.
Of course. I think one of the things that a lot of neurodiverse people struggle with is confidence.
Mm-hmm.
A lot more than people who are neurotypical. I mean, you might have for years in your head, I want to start a business. I want to work for myself. How do I do that? I don't have the confidence. I don't know what to do. People have told me that I'll be a failure because I failed at school. Mm-hmm. And they carry all this trauma and all these other things that comes with the fact they've been rejected so many times, or the fact that they don't fit into, you know, a box that everyone expects you to fit into because of the way society is built. How can you advise people that in their hearts of heart, they really want to work for themselves, but they just don't know where to start, and they just don't have the confidence because they've always told you can't do this?
The first thing that I want to say on that point is that some of the greatest achievers in human history have been neurodiverse.
Mm.
Charles Darwin was neurodiverse. Muhammad Ali was neurodiverse. Believe it or not, Einstein had dyscalculia. You know, a great scientist, a great mathematician, yet he had dyscalculia. It's amazing what neurodiverse people can achieve when they believe in themselves, despite everybody mm-hmm. throughout their life telling them that they will never achieve whatever mm-hmm. their dreams are. It's a nonsense, and it is something that neurodiverse people, it's extremely difficult to believe in yourself if everybody or a lot of people have been telling you that you're always going to fail. But yeah. Going back to that word that I used, and it's a hard word, but telling somebody that they can't do something is a nonsense. They need to find a different way of doing it. 20% of the world, I think some estimates put it at, is neurodiverse. And I think that off the top of my head, it's something like 40% of entrepreneurs are neurodiverse.
Yeah.
And when you think about it, it makes sense because a lot of neurodiverse people find the regular 9-to-5 difficult. I did as well. You know, I never was able to hold down a job for more than 3 years. And I think, to be honest, I did well doing that. If you look at my sort of full CV going all the way back to when I first had my job, there's a lot of jobs that lasted a few months. There's a lot of jobs that lasted a year for a variety of different reasons.
Yeah.
So it is a difficult position to be in. But because of that, a lot of people are able to seize entrepreneurship and make it work for them. But what I would say is somebody who is nervous, somebody who's terrified of failure, look, I'm your brother on that one because imposter complex is real, trust me.
Mm-hmm.
The best thing that you can do is not look at that sort of big goal, but how can you break that goal down into steps? Believe me, that's what neurotypical people are doing anyway. Is okay. Their overriding goal is to earn 6, 7, 8 figures a year.
Yeah.
Okay. But you can't go from zero to that overnight. Or if you can, there's very very few people who do.
I think a lot of neurodiverse places, particularly people that have dyslexia, they have big picture thinking. So mm-hmm. when the thing is just big, they think, I want to be a millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't look at the steps that it takes. Then they go, I can't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's things like it's about celebrating the small wins on that journey. So if you make a connection, for example, with somebody on LinkedIn that you've been hoping to connect with, that's a small win. Celebrate it. You know, no, it's not going to pay your bills at the end of the week. But if you keep doing it, it might do. It might lead to an opportunity here, there, wherever. But it's about breaking those huge overarching goals down into simple steps that, to be honest, we all need to feel dopamine on a regular basis. And it's about identifying those small wins so that you can build them. And that's, in my opinion, that's how you build confidence. Don't get me wrong. Counseling and therapy and everything is wonderful and it can be very helpful. And over the years, it's been very helpful to me. And I wouldn't suggest to anybody that they don't access counseling or therapy. A good counselor or therapist is an amazing ally. What I would say is that confidence, look, you've got to walk before you can run.
Of course.
And the thing is that those who try to go from 0 to 60 immediately Some of them do make it. They break their backs. They break their backs make doing it, but they very often get into boom and bust cycles. So
I feel like you're talking to me when I like 10 years ago, because I was very much like that. That's why I'm laughing.
they get into these cycles of, you know, they have a fantastic period where they're rolling in money, and then suddenly it's gone. And then they'll build it back up again, and then suddenly it's gone.
Mm.
I focus on helping business owners to build sustainable business so that you know what's coming at the end of the month. You know, you have a very good idea of the income. No, I'm not going to take you from 0 to 60 in 12 hours.
In 2 weeks. It's 12 hours, 2 weeks.
I mean, I have done it, but it's typically been with businesses that are already well established.
Yeah.
You know, like recently I did a project with Shamrock Rovers Football Club. It's a professional sports team in Ireland. And I did some work on their e-commerce store that resulted in sales growth of 363% in 30 days. But they were already selling.
Yeah.
The foundations were already in place. You know, it was a case of making the building look beautiful rather than sort of building it from the ground up.
Of course,
So I'm not saying that huge growth quickly isn't possible. It is. But it's typically with businesses that are already established.
And that's key to understand, because I think sometimes, especially if you're neurodiverse, you get caught in these kind of, I guess, scams that you see, where people are telling you, oh, become a millionaire in just 2 weeks if you do this. You know, there's loads of these pop-ups that come up maybe on YouTube or on Instagram, and they're kind of inviting you to do this. And then you get caught up into this whole process of thinking that you get these get rich quick schemes. You know, that's the right term to kind of describe them as.
Yeah.
And as a neurodivergent, I find sometimes you're more vulnerable to things like scams, because you just believe what's out there because it takes you in. Because that's happened to my husband a few times, and we've had to put precautions in place so that he doesn't get scammed again.
Yeah, and that's another element of the work that I do, is that I help businesses to be more neurodiverse friendly, and it's of things course. Like that kind of work involves, in the sense that, look, there's no greater industry for selling you silver bullets for problems than marketing. Marketing, in many capacities, marketing has a very bad name. You know, it's the... It has in many regards a similar name. I don't want to insult anybody by saying this, but it has a similar name to used car salesman.
Oh gosh.
You know. Now obviously there are plenty of very honest used car salesmen out there.
Yeah, of course.
But the stereotype of a used car salesman is there, and the stereotype of a marketer is there. And yet, as you said, many neurodiverse people are vulnerable to what amounts to scams.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why I talk about things like not promising people 0 to 60 in a fortnight. I don't discount the possibility of it happening. I don't, and as I said, as I gave the example before, it's something that I've achieved myself. But I'm not going to sell my services to anybody promising them that, because I can't guarantee it.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, when you think of things like that, you know, I just had it in my head, but basically when you have an idea of wanting to get promised, like, someone the world, they're going to think, oh, you can do that for them, and they're going to always constantly kind of accept that. Mm-hmm. But I think when you get people at a place where they can, not that it's not possible, but you want to have people be realistic in the approach of how they have their business, but also be quite positive. So it's not saying that it's not possible for you to get that, but let's look at your situation, let's look at the way your business is, and let's make a realistic plan on how we're gonna gain it traction and make you money in your business, rather than tell someone, right, in 30 days I can make you £2 million. You know, you don't want to do that. You want to make sure that it's something that is realistic for them, it's sustainable for them, and it's something they can manage.
Yeah.
And I think it's very important when you're a neurodiverse person, you want something that is manageable for you, not something that's going to overwhelm you or disappoint you too much as well.
And it's about, as I said before, it's about sustainability. So that if you sell £5,000 worth of services this month, your sales next month and the month after and the month after that are either £5,000 or they're building. They're building up. Because it's about that sustainability. And again, going back to the sort of visibility strategies that I spoke about, again, it's about sustainability. You know, I love appearing in chat on podcasts and chatting with podcast hosts. I can do that at the rate that I can do that. And there's no point in pushing me, there's no point in pushing myself over those limits, because that's not fair to me and it's not fair to the podcast host. Because it ends up, and ultimately it's not fair to the listeners, because it results in a subpar performance from me. Whereas, you know, somebody else might be comfortable being on fewer podcasts, might be comfortable being on more. And that's fine, as long as they do it within the what's sustainable for them. Same writing for blogs, same using Google Ads, same networking on LinkedIn or Facebook or in person. Do what's sustainable for you, but do it consistently.
Yeah. I think also within business as well, there's some areas that you can always outsource as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you're not, like, if you're good at doing blogs or you're good at doing podcasts and it makes you happy, you do that. But maybe the other parts of your business, you give it to someone else. So maybe you might edit, but editing takes a long, arduous process for you. So you can pass it on to someone who can do it more easily. And I think it's important in business to know that you don't have to take on everything. And I think a lot of the time with neurodiverse people, we tend to think, oh, how are we going to do this? Am I going to do that? And sometimes if you give it to someone else, it's okay. You can, doesn't have to, you don't have to take on everything, you know, and you can still grow a sustainable and successful business that way. But I think sometimes people have this in their mind that, oh, I'm going to have to pay for something and then I'm going to lose money, and it doesn't really work like that exactly. Mm-hmm. What advice could you give on someone in that, instead of thinking, if I pay someone to do something else and then spend more time doing what I'm actually good at, I can get the most out of it?
Well, I can't remember who says it, but the time that you spend on, look at your business and look at where you make the most impact. You know, are you the best salesman within your business? Are you the best manager within your business? Whatever it is that you do better than everybody else, that's the area that you need to, that's the area that you need to focus on, because every hour, every minute that you spend away from that, you're losing money because you're not giving the best performance. So, for example, my best work is the actual copywriting.
Yeah.
No, it's not preparing my accounts. It's and so on. So I get somebody to do that for me. Why? Because where I earn my bread and butter is by doing the copywriting, is by creating marketing campaigns for other businesses.
Yeah.
And if I wasn't to focus on that, then I'm losing in an area that I can be doing better in. So I wouldn't be afraid of hiring somebody to do those tasks that either you're not particularly good at or you don't enjoy. So, because if you don't enjoy them, the likelihood is you're not going to give them your best anyway.
Exactly. It's just you're just trying to do it because you want to put something out and it's not. Get someone else that can do it better than you, that doesn't all the time and it doesn't feel so heavy on them. We've all got skills and talents.
Yes.
That doesn't cause. I feel like sometimes we always underestimate, because we're so sensitive as neurodiverse people, we tend to think, oh, if I hate it, maybe the person also hates it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to put them on that pressure. So let me just do it, even though it's something I don't like to do. And I think sometimes it's hard to get out of that mindset because you think you're putting that burden on someone else. I think it's also important to understand as well that just because something's a burden to you, it doesn't mean it's a burden to someone else.
No, absolutely, absolutely not. I mean, that example that I gave is the perfect one. You know, how many business owners do their own accounts? Very, very few. Most of them hire an accountant.
Of course, yeah.
Who has gone through a long training process to get themselves in a position where they're a professional qualified accountant. Obviously, they have a passion for that. They have a flair for that. Now, you ask the average business owner, do they want to do their own accounts? Do they want to do their own taxes? No, absolutely not.
Most people don't. There's some that might, but most people don't want to do their own accounts.
Yet there are people who that's their daily work, and they've made a conscious decision for it to be their daily work. So obviously they're getting some kind of enjoyment from it. So I would say every business, or the vast majority of businesses, really are employing somebody, even if it's only the accountant. And that accountant is doing stuff that you don't enjoy, but he enjoys it, or she enjoys it, or they enjoy it. But what I would also say is that Stress can be an issue for anybody, neurotypical or neurodiverse.
But
if you're stressed by the idea of actually employing somebody, there are alternatives out there as well. You know, you don't have to take somebody into employment to have them do whatever tasks for you. COVID opened the world up on this. You know, there's loads of people, there's VAs, there's all sorts of professionals out there that are running their own business, doing something that in the past people were typically employed to do. So, you know, if you want to just hire somebody to come in and do something for you, then do that. You know, you don't have to go through the paperwork of taking somebody onto your books, if you like.
As an employee, yeah. One of the things I kind of swirled into my mind is, obviously in life we have strengths, we have weaknesses. And sometimes a lot of people say that you should focus more on your strengths rather than your weaknesses. But sometimes I think you can use your weaknesses as an anchor to your strengths.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, one of the biggest weaknesses maybe a lot of people have is public speaking. I'm terrified of public speaking. Mm-hmm. Although I have a podcast, I'm scared to speak in public. But even though that's like a weakness for me, the anchor to kind of help my weakness is to have strategies to enable me to speak in public. So maybe planning for things that could potentially affect me from speaking in public, or if I, you know, freeze, what can I do? What mechanisms can I use to anchor that weakness that I have? Do you think it's important to just focus on strength, or if you have a weakness that you have, is there a way that you can use the strength you have to anchor on that weakness? I hope I'm making some sense. Yeah.
What I would say is that weaknesses over time can become strengths. So absolutely, absolutely not. I would never say to somebody that they shouldn't focus on growing in an area that they're weak. I was a teacher for many years, and so kind of public speaking doesn't faze me because I did it for a long time in a different capacity, but networking in person kind of makes me freeze. So I typically my networking is on LinkedIn, but I do go to in-person networking meetings, but I do it by having a very clear framework of how I'm going to do that. So going, for example, for the first time for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, and coming away. Something that seems achievable, and then progressively increasing it. Okay. So that so when you were talking about public speaking, can you find events where you would only be expected to speak for a very short window of time?
Mm.
You know, and then build on that. So you get that under your belt, you feel more confident, and then you do longer the next time, and a little bit longer and a little bit longer. The same with your skills. You know, if it's an area that is so important that you can't afford to sort of make a mess of it and start again.
Yeah.
Then get somebody, hire somebody in who is more experienced to help you and to show you. It's like, for example, with copywriting, I don't only do the writing for businesses. I help them to do it for themselves. So that when they need my help, they know where I am. But they're also able to pick up things and do things for themselves, so that they don't feel constrained to have to come to me for everything. Because I think that knowledge is power, and the more knowledge you have, the more empowered you become.
Of course. And you can apply that knowledge to your business and ensure that you're getting the most from the knowledge that's given to you. Yeah, definitely. I did have a question, and now it's gone. This is why I should write things down. Dyslexia, gosh. It'll probably come back to me. This is so bad. There is a thing about going back on the fact of public speaking and obviously presenting yourself and taking chunks at a time. In terms of, like, if it's not public speaking or it's any other kind of thing that you're weak at, what are the general strengths you find that a lot of neurodiverse people have? Because you said at least 40% of people who are neurodiverse tend to be entrepreneurs. Where are the strengths you see? Because I feel like with entrepreneurship, generally a lot of entrepreneurs tend to be problem solvers. They tend to be quite intuitive, good instincts. And these are kind of strengths that a lot of neurodiverse people have. You've come across a lot of entrepreneurs who are neurodiverse, I would imagine. Where are the strengths that you see in them? And how do you see that helping them elevate their business further and grow more? And I know with a lot of neurodiverse people that I've come across, the biggest challenge for them is just confidence and feeling that they are part of the conversation or part of a, I guess, tribe or the business world and feeling that they're not really part of it. Those are the weaknesses I see, but like in terms of the strengths, what do you see, being that you've come across a lot of businesses?
I think that one of the main areas of strength that I see is I don't want to say that neurotypical people aren't genuine. There are loads of neurotypical people who are genuine. But going back to that point that I made earlier, that a lot of neurodiverse people, and again reiterating the fact that I really do stress not all, because you can't say all, but a lot of neurodiverse people find those spammy sales tactics, those really hard buy now or lose out sales tactics, that they find them icky, they find them uncomfortable. When they do find the strategies that work for them, in my experience, neurodiverse people are very good at building communities around their businesses. So they build sustainability kind of almost organically, because they're serving their people rather than just trying to sell to their people. So their people then know, like, and trust them, which all feeds into the sales cycle and all feeds into keeping those businesses sustainable. Some neurodiverse people, their attention to detail is
off the roof.
Off the roof. Neurodiverse people I can't do it myself, I'll be honest. But some neurodiverse people are able to just sit at a task and work at it until it's done. You know, I need breaks. I need a coffee now and again. I need to sleep. I'm that kind of a person. But, you know, it's very difficult to pinpoint strengths that neurodiverse people have as a whole, because within the neurodiverse community, there are millions of individuals. You know, and it's really important not to lose sight of that. And individuals have their own strengths. But yeah, most of the people that I work with, once we've been able to find the the strategies that fit for them have been exceptionally good at building communities around their businesses that are nourishing and are self-nourishing and keep those businesses going, both in the good times and in the bad times. The other thing that I would say to neurodiverse people is that the neurodiverse community itself, in my experience, I don't know about yours, Sarah, but in my experience, tends to be very supportive.
Yeah.
Tends to be very friendly, tends to be very accepting and welcoming. And that is a strength that every neurodiverse person can tap into, but can also provide input into. So, you know,
I find that a lot of neurodiverse people are a lot more welcoming, they're more open.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost easier to approach someone that gets you.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah.
And also remember that if you are neurodiverse yourself, you are really well placed to serve other neurodiverse people because you get what it means to be neurodiverse. I mean, Sarah, you and I have different neurodiversities.
Yeah.
But we do have an understanding of what it means
to be
neurodiverse, living in a neurotypical world.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the stigmas that people get attached with, some of the things that neurodiverse people get told. I mean, going back to when we were chatting before we started recording the podcast.
Yeah.
When I was in school, awareness wasn't what it is today. So
no.
I was always termed as a naughty child. You know, they didn't look past the behavior to find out what was going on behind the scenes for me.
Yeah.
Other neurodiverse people through school, for example, have been told that they're stupid, that they're always going to fail. So we do have an understanding and a compassion that I think at times the neurotypical world doesn't get. So particularly if you're a service provider, you're in a really good position to help other neurodiverse people.
Obviously, there's more and more neurodiversity, and I don't know whether, maybe from a neurodiverse perspective as a dyslexic woman, I still feel there's a stigma about being dyslexic. Even sometimes I'm afraid that I put myself out publicly and saying, oh, I'm dyslexic, I have ADHD, what will people think about me? I still have that. There's a sense of, I don't know how to explain that, a sense of shame that comes with that. And sometimes I have to tell myself that there's nothing to be ashamed of, but it's still there because that maybe that comes from a sense of maybe trauma or growing up knowing that if I told people I have a neurodiverse condition, there wasn't even a term like that when I was growing up. It was just that you were thick, you were dumb.
Mm-hmm.
We were stupid, yeah. You know, it still tingles in my head that, oh, I don't want to tell people I'm dyslexic. It almost makes me feel like, oh, I don't want to tell people that I'm dyslexic. But I am dyslexic.
Yeah.
And it's that thing I have to play in my head all the time that it's something that I've accepted that I am a neurodiverse person, but sometimes it's hard to accept it and knowing that people will accept you.
Yeah,
with these conditions, I don't know whether that plagues your mind, but it does mine a lot.
Yeah, definitely. And I think actually that recently, there's lots of criticism that we can make of television soap operas. You know, some of the stories are so far-fetched, they're completely unrealistic. But at the moment, and before I mention the character's name, some of the storylines that he's been involved in are sort of off the scale, far-fetched. But
I think
at the moment that EastEnders is doing a good job with Ben Mitchell in raising awareness and showing him going through the struggles of dealing with the stigma that's attached to what he's gone through at the moment. Because he, the character has done a lot of bad things in the past, but he's also in the last 12 months or so, and I stress it's a soap opera character that we're talking about. It's not a real person, but within the last 12 months, he was raped, and the mother of his 10 or 11 year old child died. And he's taken it particularly badly. And he's had, you know, issues with eating disorders, with depression, and so on. And it actually is showing the challenges that he's facing accessing counseling and therapy. And I know that somebody who has accessed counseling and therapy for similar issues, depression and anxiety in the past, even when you go into that room with the therapist or the counselor, you feel that stigma. You know that that person is there to help you and is there to listen to you and is working with loads of people like you.
Yeah.
You still feel that stigma. And I think
interesting you say that, you know, because I have a friend who's in therapy, and we always have this dispute about therapy. I'm not saying therapy is not good, but I feel like, I don't know if it worked for me. and it's like we'll have this argument, like we really get on very well, but I'm like, I don't feel therapy will work for me. I'm too, you know, I psychoanalyze people too much. I don't want someone trying to fix my brain. Like, that's how I am. And she's like, no, it really helps. You just need to find the right therapist. I'm like, no, don't tell me that nonsense. Like, that's just how, and maybe one day she might get me on her side and, you know, I might do therapy, but like, I've had experience of, I'm not saying this from a place of, not actually experiencing therapy, because I went to therapist, I didn't have a great experience. Mm-hmm. And I thought when I was talking to this therapist, she was just talking about herself. So I just felt like this is not for me. But I guess with therapy, you have to, maybe it's almost like dating, you've got to find the right therapist for you.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think because of that, I've always like, oh no, it's not going to work for me. But I don't take away from people that do have therapy and how much that's changed their life and it's changed for them. But for me, I'm like, I'm still on that. I don't know. I have to get there one day.
one of the moments that I can remember most clearly recognizing stigma is when I went to a particular therapist. And he said to me, I sat down and he said, okay, I've looked at your notes. I can see that you have CPTSD. I can see that you have anxiety and depression. I'm your brother. And that just melted the stigma in that situation, because I knew by what he'd said that he had these things himself. So, I mean, he's not going to judge me because he's gone through the same things himself. And I think that's a superpower that neurodiverse people have with helping each other, is that we understand, okay, we don't all have the same challenges, but we understand what the other person, you know, what other people challenge.
We're quite empathetic.
Yeah. Mm. And that's why I say that one of the superpowers, not the only superpower, but one of the superpowers is that neurodiverse people are very good at helping other neurodiverse people. They're very good at helping neurotypical people too.
Oh, yeah, we are.
But I think that it's very difficult for a neurotypical person to get a neurodiverse person.
Yeah.
Not impossible, but difficult.
Yeah, it is hard. I had a question, actually. For some of the audience members, they might not know what... You said this to me.
CPTSD. Yeah.
Yeah, like, what is that? Because you explained it to me. I've never heard of it. I've heard of PTSD, but I've never heard of the C in front of the PTSD. Do you want to explain that for the audience members? And how that differs and how that is seen as a neurodivergent condition?
I'll be honest with you, it's difficult for me because I'm not a doctor. I don't have any medical training. So when I talk about CPTSD and the differences between that and PTSD, I'm sort of talking through the lens of what I've understood by what has been told to me from my reading and processing it through my own lens. There'll be other people out there who have CPTSD that don't have the same experiences and don't experience it in the same way. But my understanding of it is that CPTSD affects your thought processes, whereas PTSD is more linked to, for example, high anxiety, panicking in situations where the danger or something similar to the danger that's previously been experienced seems to be present again. CPTSD is something that kind of affects you in your everyday life and affects your thought processes and has many of the same symptoms, not all, but many of the same symptoms as autism.
Right. So there's complex, which is a C, and then obviously the P is post-traumatic stress disorder. And I only know about post-traumatic stress disorder because of people that came, like war veterans. That's when it was first kind of identified, and then they kind of recognized it in people in everyday life that they've had a very traumatic experience. They kind of block that experience, put it in the back of their mind, and all of a sudden it comes back to them. I think that's how it works. I might be wrong, but yeah.
Like, okay, this might be a very simplistic scenario, but let's say a soldier that's returned from a war zone, and please, I apologize in advance if this is rather simplistic, but it's just an example that I'm trying to use. A soldier coming back from a war zone where he's seen a lot, or she's seen a lot of death, she's seen a lot of bombing, shootings, and so on, and is suddenly back in their home city, and they hear a loud noise, be it a car backfiring, be it an explosion, be it something very heavy dropping. And suddenly their trauma is triggered again. Because of the experiences they've been through. CPTSD, my understanding of it is that it's not those sort of trigger moments. It's all the time.
It's consistent.
Yeah. But it probably doesn't have sort of the very high peaks that PTSD has. It affects you on a consistent, this is my understanding, it affects you on a consistent basis. And what I've been told anyway, there might be somebody out there, listener, who can correct this, but what I've been told is that CPTSD is typically caused by periods over an elongated period of time. So say, for example, when I was in school, I was quite badly bullied for years. So that is a long chunk of my life where I didn't feel safe.
Yeah.
And that has obviously influenced my thought processes. And an example of where, my understanding anyway, an example of where CPTSD is similar in ways to autism, although the causation is completely different, is like if I'm in a busy city, it becomes too much for me very, very quickly. So it's like, say, for example, I can't cope with more than, let's say, an afternoon in somewhere like Dublin or London. It becomes too much for me very, very quickly. Yeah. I live out in the countryside, where
that's lovely.
the loudest noise really is a dog barking.
Oh gosh, I'm in the heart of London, and we hear sirens and madness.
Yeah,
but today's quite quiet at the moment. So
yeah,
we haven't heard any sirens yet.
No, I was in London not last weekend, the weekend before last.
Yeah,
and yeah, the noise, it albeit where I was staying was very quiet during the night, but the noise during the day, it's just, it doesn't work for me. And what I found is that my CPTSD symptoms have worsened over the years, and I become less and less comfortable in the Londons or the Dublins or the Romes or the Parises as a result. Really, to be honest, give me the countryside and I'm happy. It's boring for some people. And if you are used to living in the centre of London,
you and my husband will get on, because he doesn't want to live in London and I like London.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "No, London's too noisy. I want to leave London. It's too much." And I'm like, "But I love it here, you know." But
but I'm certain if you came out and you spent a couple of weeks out where I live, you'd be bored out of
your mind. I think I've been conditioned to like London because I went to school in London. I did everything in London. So maybe my brain has been conditioned.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if I was in a much more quiet environment, I might get things done better. And it's probably worsening my ADHD, but I've adapted to it, if that makes sense.
But are you originally from London?
I'm originally from London. Okay. So, yeah.
I think a lot of it depends on where you grew up. I grew up in the countryside in North Wales, and I live in the countryside in Ireland. So it's what I'm used to. I think if you're used to a big city, you're happier in a big city. Typically, not always, but typically.
I guess so. Yeah, probably. He grew up in a much quieter environment. I grew up in chaos like this. Yeah. And sometimes it's not good to be comfortable in chaos. You get comfortable in things that are not healthy. So I think as I get older, I'm trying to settle down a lot more in terms of being in more calmer environments, because it does help. But you think it's normal to be that way, because I thought that everyone is like this, and then I realised that the way I am is not normal.
Yeah.
you begin to see these things. I always go into a little bit more detail about positives and negatives of being neurodiverse, and also what advice could you give to somebody who is a neurodiverse person, they want to start a business, but the main issue they have is finding the confidence to do that. What one piece of advice can you give them? So the two questions I have is, what are the positives and negatives of being neurodiverse and overcoming those negatives? And then the second part is, business owner, neurodiverse, what can you say to encourage where you lack confidence?
Where you lack confidence, my sort of biggest practical advice is that you can't build confidence overnight. You're not going to go to bed lacking confidence and wake up full of confidence. So what you have to do is break those big goals down into smaller ones so that you are achieving regularly. If you say, okay, I want to start my own business and I want to be earning six figures, that ain't going to happen overnight. And if you convince yourself that that is the only goal, then it's going to seem too big at the outset, and B, it's going to take you so long to achieve that your confidence is going to be destroyed by the time that you get there, or before the time that you get there. So it's about breaking things down into those small, achievable goals. Maybe getting a new lead. Maybe taking on one small client who doesn't pay you very much, but you do a good job for them. And really celebrating that. Don't say, but it's not my main goal. Really celebrate it. You know, it's a big achievement to do a job for somebody that they're happy with. Yeah, it's a hell of an achievement. And you should be really proud of that. And that's how you build confidence, not by kind of climbing the mountain in the quickest way possible, by just slowly and in a way that's sustainable for you, growing and taking note of those small achievements on the way, so that in a month you can look back on 10 small things that you achieved. In 6 months, you can look back on 100. In 12 months, and so on, so that you're constantly saying, no, this bit is going well. And then that means that because you've achieved things that you hadn't before, it makes future challenges look more surmountable because you've already done it.
So just small little goals, bit by bit by bit, to feel that you've achieved. And the next thing for people that are neurodiverse, positives and negatives. So if you've got a negative condition with your neurodiversity, how can you see the positives in that and the positives of being neurodiverse typically? Because I don't want to say it's all the same, we're all different, but typically.
Yeah. Okay, from my own perspective, I spoke about cold emailing not working for me. And that was a weakness that I had. And it's a strange weakness in that I've been able to do it for other businesses successfully, but I haven't been able to do it for myself. So I think, you know, there's a confidence issue there. But it was a negative for me, and it's a negative that lots of other neurodiverse people face, because of some of the issues that we spoke about earlier. But a positive out of that is that there are other methods that you can use that are more focused on relationship building, for example. You know, so for me personally, getting on to podcasts as a guest is fantastic because I'm building connections with really good people, really interesting people and really diverse people. So, yeah, I could look at the cold email and say that it's a negative, but the silver lining of this is this other thing that I've learned to do as a result of not being good at the first thing that I tried. So the negatives, broadening it out to other people, the negatives are that, you know, you will probably find at the start that there are things that don't work for you. But the positive thing, the positives are that you, if you keep trying, you'll find other things that do work really well and probably serve you better in the long run.
Andrew, would you leave your details of how people can find you and what they could do if they wanted to get help growing their business? Even neurodiverse, if they're not neurodiverse, maybe even neurotypical, mm-hmm. how can they find you? Do you have an Instagram account? Do you have a LinkedIn, Facebook?
I'm most active on LinkedIn. As Andrew McDonald, and my banner is the Neurodivergent Copywriter. So you'll know it if you see me. The logo in the middle of the banner is a bull terrier, and that's because There have been scientific studies done on animals to try and find neurodiversities within animals. And out of dogs, bull terriers are the ones that exhibit the most neurodivergent tendencies. Don't ask me to...
We may have to have a discussion on this later because I've never heard of this.
And... also, I have a book which is available free that will take neurodivergent entrepreneurs through the process of building a marketing outreach campaign that works for them. And that's
if you give me the link to that book, I'll put it in the show notes so that listeners can download it.
That's at www.andrewmcdonaldmcdonald.biz/book.
And that's it. Is that it?
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
It's been lovely having you as a guest on Divine Enigma. All the information on how to get hold of Andrew will be in the show notes, or there will be in the link in YouTube because it will also go on YouTube as well. You can contact him and yeah, he can help you build your business as a neurodivergent, or if you're neurotypical, you can also get help from Andrew as well. So drop him a line and he'll get back to you. Have you got any final words to say, Andrew, before we sort of conclude our podcast episodes?
The one thing that I would say is always believe in yourself, even if people have told you in the past that you would never amount to anything. Don't believe it. It really is nonsense that has come from a position of ignorance on the part of the person telling you that. And if you find something that's not working for you, I mean, I encourage people to give things a good go before dropping them. But if you find things that are not working for you or aren't sustainable for you, there is always a different way.
That's right. It's always options. And again, obviously, if you're building small, like little small increments, you can kind of pick out where what is it working for you, mm-hmm. is working for you, and you know, to drop stuff and keep it. So that's brilliant advice, Andrew. Okay, Andrew, thank you again.
Thanks for being so on the much, podcast. Sarah.
It's been an honour to have you on this podcast.
And it's been an honour for so me much to be here.
Oh, thank you. I'm always happy to have people on my podcast, so I'm very grateful. So thank you so much, Andrew, again for your time, and take care.
Thanks very much, Sarah.
I want to let our audience member know about the 6-week coaching program on offer that I'll be helping people who are neurodivergent specifically, but you could also be neurotypical, who want to improve their career prospects in general, and or for those who want to get into project management. I've mentioned this before in previous episodes. I'm not trying to sell it very hard, but it is a very good program if you just want to get a good foundation of what it is like from a, I guess, technical perspective as a project manager, and also learn it from a neurodiverse perspective, being that I'm a neurodivergent and I've had a lived experience of this. Again, if I'm not able to help you with your neurodiversity, I have a whole heap of people that I can put you in contact with that can ensure that you get the support you need with your neurodiversity in terms of learning. I'm also offering support for people who want to pass the PRINCE 2 practitioner exam, as I've failed the test a few times myself, and I'd like to help others show them how I passed. So if this sounds interesting to you, or you'd like to learn more, please reach out to me directly. I'm on social media, so I'm on Instagram. I'm also on YouTube. You can contact me in various ways. You can email me at hello@divineenigma.org. I will be going on LinkedIn and other few platforms, but I'm sort of gearing myself up to it. There's also my website, which is divineenigma.org, where you can get some of the resources that you need. And also in the next few months coming up, I'll be setting up a membership business as well, for people that want to get into project management, and also for people who are looking for tools and resources they can use to help them manage their neurodiversity at work, as well as starting a side hustle, and also how to navigate themselves within their career if they want to be in employment. I also have a podcast episode around employment and entrepreneurship. And actually, this podcast episode that is that you've been listening to right now is mostly about entrepreneurship. So you should get a lot of information on this from listening to the podcast. So, as I love to say all the time, please follow me on all platforms where you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to me. You've got to the end. I know it's been a long podcast, but you've got to the end. And I'm glad that you got to the end, because obviously I've done a great job. But this is a safe place for project managers and professionals to give you the tools and tips on how to navigate the complexity of being neurodiverse in the workplace. I will see you soon. Take care. Bye for now. Yeah.